I don't think they were turning cartwheels, he said.
So will they abort, or will they come back?
Only one way to find out. We wait and see. They waited. The sun fell away into afternoon, and the temperature dropped like a stone. The clock ticked 3,600 times every hour. Nagley went out for a walk and came back with a bag from the grocery store. They ate an improvised lunch. Then they developed a new lookout pattern based on the fact that no vehicle could get all the way through either field of view in less than about 8 minutes. So they sat comfortably, and every 5 minutes, by Nagley's watch, they knelt up and shuffled over to their louvers and scanned the length of the road. Each time there was a small thrill of anticipation, and each time it was disappointed. But the regular physical movement helped against the cold. They started stretching in place to keep loose. They did push-ups to keep warm. The spare rounds in their pockets jingled loudly. Battle rattle, Nagley called it. From time to time, Reacher pressed his face against the louvers and stared out at the snowfall in the west. The clouds were still low and black, held back by an invisible wall about 50 miles away.
They won't come back, Nagley said. They'd have to be insane to try anything here.
I think they are insane, Reacher said. He watched and waited and listened to the clock. He had had enough just before 4 o'clock. He used the blade of his knife to cut through the accumulation of old white paint and lifted one of the louvers out of the frame. It was a simple length of wood, maybe 3 feet long, maybe 4 inches wide, maybe an inch thick. He held it out in front of him like a spear and crawled over and pushed it into the clock mechanism. The gear wheels jammed on it, and the clock stopped. He pulled the wood out again, and crawled away, and slotted it back in the frame. The silence was suddenly deafening. They watched and waited. It got colder, to the point where they both started shivering. But the silence helped. Suddenly it helped a lot. Reacher crawled over and checked his partial view to the west again, and then crawled back and picked up the map. Stared at it hard, lost in thought. He used his finger and thumb like a compass and measured distances. 40, 80, 120, 160 miles. Slow, faster, fast, slow. Overall average speed, maybe 40. That's 4 hours. Sun sets in the west, he said. Rises in the east.
On this planet, Nagley said.
Then they heard the staircase creak below them. They heard feet on the ladder. The trapdoor lifted an inch and fell back, and then crashed all the way open, and the vicar put his head up into the bell chamber and stared at the submachine gun pointing at him from one side and the M16 rifle from the other.
"I need to talk to you about those things," he said. "You can't expect me to be happy about having weapons in my church."
He stood there on the ladder, looking like a severed head. Reacher laid the M16 back on the floor. The vicar stepped up another rung.
"I understand the need for security," he said, "and we're honored to host the vice president-elect, but I really can't permit engines of destruction in a hallowed building. I would have expected somebody to discuss it with me."
"Engines of destruction?" Nagley repeated.
"What time does the sun set?" Reacher asked. The vicar looked a little surprised by the change of subject, but he answered very politely.
"Soon," he said. "It falls behind the mountains quite early here, but you won't see it happen today. There are clouds. There's a snowstorm coming in from the west."
"And when does it rise?"
"This time of year? A little before 7 o'clock, I suppose."
"You heard a weather report for tomorrow?"
"They say much the same as today."
"Okay," Reacher said. "Thanks."
Did you stop the clock?"
"It was driving me nuts."
"That's why I came up. Do you mind if I set it going again?"
Reacher shrugged. "It's your clock."
"I know the noise must be bothersome."
"Doesn't matter," Reacher said. "We'll be out of here as soon as the sun sets. Weapons and all." The vicar hauled himself all the way up into the chamber and leaned over the iron girders and fiddled with the mechanism. There was a setting device linked to a separate miniature clock that Reacher hadn't noticed before. It was buried within the gear wheels. It had an adjustment lever attached to it. The vicar checked his wristwatch and used the lever to force the exterior hands around to the correct time. The miniature clock hands moved with them. Then he simply turned a gear wheel with his hand until the mechanism picked up the momentum for itself and started again on its own. The heavy thunk, thunk, thunk came back. The smallest bell rang in sympathy, one tiny resonance for every second that passed.
"Thank you,"
the vicar said. "An hour, at most," Reacher said. "Then we'll be gone." The vicar nodded like his point was made, and threaded himself down through the trapdoor, pulled it closed after him.
"We can't leave here," Negley said. "Are you crazy? They could come in at night easy as anything. Maybe that's exactly what they're waiting for. They could drive back in without headlights."
Reacher glanced at his watch. "They're already here, or almost here."
"Where?"
"I'll show you." He pulled the louver out of the frame again and handed it to her, crawled under the clock shaft to the bottom of the next ladder that led up through the roof to the outside, climbed up it, and eased the roof trapdoor open.
"Stay low," he called.
He swam out, keeping his stomach flat on the roof. The construction was just about identical to the Bismarck roof. There was soldered lead sheathing built up into a shallow box, drains in the corners, a substantial anchor for the flagpole and the weather vane and the lightning rod, and a 3-foot wall all around the edge. He turned a circle on his stomach and leaned down and took the louver from Nagley. Then he got out of her way and let her crawl up next to him. The wind was strong and the air was bitterly cold. "Now we kind of kneel low," he said, "close together, facing west." They knelt together, shoulder to shoulder, hunched down. He was on the left and she was on the right. He could still hear the clock. He could feel it through the lead and the heavy wooden boards. "Okay, like this," he said. He held the louver in front of his face with his left hand holding the left end. She took the right end in her right hand. They shuffled forward on their knees until they were tight against the low wall. He eased his end of the louver level with the top of the wall. She did the same. "More," he said, "until we've got a slit to see through." They raised it higher in concert until it was horizontal with an inch of space between its lower edge and the top of the wall. They gazed out through the gap. They would be visible if somebody was watching the tower very carefully, but overall it was a pretty unobtrusive tactic. As good as he could improvise, anyway. "Look west," he said. "Maybe a little bit south of west." They squinted into the setting sun. They could see 40 miles of waving grass. It was like an ocean, bright and golden in the evening backlight. Beyond it was the darkening snowstorm. The area between was misty, and sheets of late sunlight speared backward through it right at them. There were shifting curtains of sun and shadow and color and rainbows that started nowhere and ended nowhere. "Watch the grassland," he said.
"What am I looking for?"
"You'll see it." They knelt there for minutes. The sun inched lower, the last rays tilted flatter into their eyes. Then they saw it. They saw it together. About a mile out into the sea of grass, the dying sun flashed gold once on the roof of the Tahoe. It was crawling east through the grassland, very slowly, coming directly toward them, bouncing gently over the rough terrain, lurching up and down through the dips and the hollows at walking speed. "They were smart," Reacher said. "They read the map and had the same idea you did, to exit across open country to the west. But then they looked at the town and knew they had to come in that way, too." The sun slid into the low clouds 50 miles west, and the resulting shadow raced east across the grassland, and the golden light died. Twilight came down like a circuit breaker had popped open, and then there was nothing more to be seen. They lowered the louver screen and ducked away flat to the roof, crawled across the lead and back down into the bell chamber. Nagley threaded her way under the clock shaft and picked up the Heckler and Koch. "Not yet," Reacher said.
"So when?"
"What will they do now?"
"I guess they'll get as close as they dare. Then they'll set up and wait."
Reacher nodded. "They'll turn the truck around and park it facing west in the best hollow they can find, about 100-200 yards out. They'll check their sight lines to the east and make sure they can see but can't be seen. Then they'll sit tight and wait for Armstrong to show."
"That's 14 hours.
Exactly, Reacher said. We're going to leave them out there all night. We'll let them get cold and stiff and tired. Then the sun will rise right in their eyes. We'll be coming at them out of the sun. They won't even see us.
They hid the long guns under the pew nearest the church door and left the Yukon parked where it was, walked up toward the bridge and took two rooms in the boarding house. Then they headed for the grocery store to get dinner ingredients. The sun was gone and the temperature was below freezing. There was snow in the air again. Big, feathery flakes were drifting around, reluctant to settle. They swirled and hung in the air and rose back up like tiny birds. The breakfast counter was all closed down, but the woman in the store offered to microwave something from the freezer cabinet. She seemed to assume Reacher and Nagley were a Secret Service advance detail. Everybody seemed to know Armstrong was expected at the service. She heated up some meat pies and some slushy vegetables. They ate them at the darkened counter. They tasted as good as field rations. The woman wouldn't take money for them. The rooms in the boarding house were clean, as advertised. They had walls paneled with pine boards, rag rugs on the floors, one single bed in each, with flowery counterpanes washed so many times they were nearly transparent. There was a bathroom at the far end of the corridor. Reacher let Nagley take the room nearer to it. Then she joined him in his room for a spell, because she was restless and wanted to talk. They sat side by side on the bed, because there was no other furniture.
"We'll be going up against a prepared position," she said.
"The two of us against two bozos," Reacher replied. "You worried now?"
"It's gotten harder."
"Tell me again. I'm not making you do this, am I?"
"You can't do it alone."
He shook his head. "I could do it alone, one-handed, with my head in a bag."
"We know nothing about them."
"But we can make some kind of an assessment. The tall guy in Bismarck is the shooter, and the other guy watches his back and drives. Big brother, little brother. There'll be a lot of loyalty. It's a brother thing. This whole deal is a brother thing. Explaining the motivation to somebody who wasn't close would be hard. You can't just walk up to a stranger and say, 'Hey, I want to shoot a guy because his dad threatened to put a stick up my ass and I had to beg him not to.'" Nagley said nothing. "I'm not asking you to participate," Reacher said. Nagley smiled.
"You're an idiot. I'm worried about you, not me."
"Nothing's going to happen to me," Reacher said. "I'm going to die an old man in some lonely motel bed."
"This all is a brother thing for you too, isn't it?"
He nodded. "Has to be. I don't really give a damn about Armstrong. I liked Froelich, but I would never have known her except for Joe."
"Are you lonely?"
"Sometimes. Not usually." She moved her hand very slowly. It started an inch from his hand. She made the inch last like a million miles. Her fingers moved imperceptibly over the washed-out counterpane until they were a fraction from his. Then they lifted and moved more until they were directly over his and just a fraction above. It was like there was a layer of air between their hands, compressed so hard it was warm and liquid. She floated her hand on the air and kept it motionless. Then she pressed harder and brought it down, and her fingers touched the backs of his fingers, very lightly. She turned her elbow so her hand lay precisely aligned. Then she pushed down harder. Her palm felt warm. Her fingers were long and cool. Their tips lay on his knuckles. They moved and traced the lines and scars and tendons. They raked down between his. He turned his hand over. She pressed her palm into his, laced her fingers through his fingers, and squeezed. He squeezed back. He held her hand for 5 long minutes. Then she slowly pulled it away, stood up, stepped to the door, smiled.
"See you in the morning," she said.
He slept badly and woke up at 5, worried about the endgame. Complications crowded in on him. He threw back the covers and slipped out of bed, dressed in the dark, and walked down the stairs and out into the night. It was bitter cold and the snowflakes were blowing in faster. They looked wet and heavy. The weather was moving east, which was good, he guessed. There was no light. All the town's windows were dark. There were no street lights, there was no moon, there were no stars. The church tower loomed up in the middle distance, faint and gray and ghostly. He walked in the middle of the dirt road and crossed the graveyard, found the church door and went inside, crept up the tower stairs by feel, found the ladder in the dark and climbed up into the bell chamber. The clock ticked loudly, louder than in the daytime. It sounded like a mad blacksmith beating his iron hammer against his anvil once a second.